How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is this guy, the founder of VidHit, Gary Lavin. He took a chance on me way back in 2019 and he was episode 25 of this podcast when I had zero listeners. We now catch up 5 years later when we both have grown a lot. He's doing over 50 million bottles globally per year and has built a massive Irish brand. Here's my chat with Gary. Gary, welcome back to the pod.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
August 2019 was the last time we sat down.
That's right.
I can't believe you actually did it. It was episode 25. I don't even know what possessed you to say yes.
Well, I read somewhere that no matter how big or how small, you should always say yes to things. And who knew how big you were going to get?
Well, that's true. It was mad, actually. Yeah, I remember walking down the canal and I had two microphones in my bag, walking up to your office and plonking them out on the table and trying to connect to my laptop. I didn't have an absolute clue. I can tell you that now.
I think at the time, you were probably one of three people that year who'd asked me to be in a podcast, maybe two. So there wasn't actually that many people asking. And now
three per week.
Yeah, it's a lot of podcasts now. But if I'm ever in the area, I might get inundated now. But if I'm ever in the area and I have time, I would always do it, yeah.
So let's do the whistle stop tour 2019 to now. First of all, just tell people who are living under a rock and not watching YouTube and can't see what it is. What is VidHit?
VidHit is this product here in front of me. It's a low calorie and low sugar vitamin drink. And I created it all the way back in 1998 and registered my company in 2000. And the whole idea behind it was I saw everybody drinking sugary drinks and I just thought there must be an alternative way. And I had no history whatsoever in the drinks business. But I thought I could, in my naivety, I thought I could just take on the business and win straight away without even knowing how to do it. I just had this idea and I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. And about 9 years later, I was losing a lot of money, lost my house, lost my car. At that stage, it wasn't a great idea, but I hung in there and came out the other end. And now VidHit is doing quite well in about 16 different territories around the world.
Would you start VidHit today in 2024 if you knew now what you knew didn't know then?
I would, because I'm the eternal optimist, and if you told me it's going to take, I don't know, maybe 11, 12 years to break even, I'd say, no, I can do it faster. So even though I've proven it to myself that you can't, I still wouldn't believe it, because optimism for me always comes first. But yeah, I went through a lot of hard times, but it's definitely worth it in the long run, as most things are. You know, when you're living through something, and you wake up every morning and you've got banks of solicitors' letters at your door and you can't open your door, it's pretty frightening. But the one thing I would say is I didn't have dependents back then. I often feel really bad for people who are in business and they go under that kind of pressure and they have a wife and kids to provide for. I didn't have any of that. So it was just me. So if I was going to lose my house and my car, which I did, it was just me. And, I could always go back to the parents' house and stay there. So it wasn't like I was going to be completely homeless. So I never really thought it as an existential threat that I would have if it was today. So if you were to say today with family, would I do it? I'm more risk averse now. So I probably wouldn't put my family at risk now.
How do you think entrepreneurs can start if they have dependents? Because you hear a lot of kind of like comments, and we've had it multiple times in the pod. Very successful entrepreneurs like yourself and even Peter Coppinger a few weeks ago said, oh, I don't know if I could do it now with family and kids. But a lot of people listening do have family and kids and do want to start. So how would you get over that hurdle? Because you're the optimist, you live away.
Yeah. I think there always is a way, and it just depends on how hooked in you are in your current job. If you've got nothing to lose, you've got nothing to lose, right? I know a lot of people who started up in COVID when they lost their jobs and they had nothing to lose. So you find a way. I think the safe way is I met a bunch of people when I was away recently, and school teachers, and they said to me, I just got chatting to them and they said to me, well, how did you actually start? And I said, well, back in the time I bought a house. And they said, well, you can't do that now. I said, no, but I would go on Google Maps and I would find a new up and coming tourist area. I would get a job so I'd be able to get a mortgage for that. And I would find, so Sri Lanka, for instance, is the closest stop off, surfing stop off to Dubai. And Dubai is tripling its economy. and houses in Sri Lanka near a beach are like 40,000 euros. So I would do something like that, because I actually, back in the day before my drinks company, I was buying and selling the odd apartment. And yes, you can't do that now. But if I was, had a job here, and if I wanted to get to a certain destination, obviously you couldn't do what I did back in the day, where I bought an apartment, sold an apartment, made some money and put it into a company. But there's always other ways. So I would go to Sri Lanka. I would try and get a mortgage from the local government there. I would buy something for 40 grand. I would Airbnb it out and take 5 years, and then maybe buy another one, try and build that way. I think it's too easy to say you can't do it in Ireland, you can't do it in England, therefore I can't do it. There's always ways, I think.
Are you an early stage founder solving problems in the food supply chain? The Green Man Group sees the value in your work and has launched the Growing Further Awards to back your vision. These awards are designed to promote startups that are driving sustainability and innovation in key areas of the food supply chain, including production, distribution and retail, built environment, and customer engagement. Enter at growingfurther.io for a shot at a share of the €100,000 cash prize and the chance to pitch your company to a crowd of industry leaders. Don't miss out. The deadline for entries is October 4th, with final judging and the awards set for January 2025. Learn more and apply at growingfurther.io.
If you've been listening for a while, you know Iconic Offices have been my partner for ages now. Working and recording out of their flexible workspaces has meant a huge deal to the success of this podcast. So it made perfect sense to partner up with them again, but to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, a unique offer. Come work in the Iconic Office workspaces for free with no catches. Simply visit the link in the description below and enter Gary24 for a free day pass or a free day office pass. Enjoy.
And we live in a global economy. I think that's, if we haven't learned that from COVID, we'll never learn it, is that you can't just look backwards and go, oh yeah, you know, easy for you to say 15 years ago, can't do that now. We've now more access to anything and anywhere. Like, you're literally a flight or two away from any part of the world now, and it's pretty cost effective.
Yeah, and we have the internet. We didn't have that in my day. And look, I gave a talk about 15 years ago, so every generation thinks the same thing, but there's always problems in every generation, and I'm not discounting it at all. Like, it is virtually impossible for young people to buy a house, and that has to change around here. But when I was leaving school, I didn't go to college. I went to the University of Life. So I was leaving school. Everybody at the time was leaving the country to make money and in order to come back. And it has now gone full circle. Obviously, we had the tech boom, etc., and that's now gone down a little bit. But people are having to go abroad again, which is sad, but it's the Irish way. We've done it for generations. So I don't think people should be too afraid of that. If you can't make your ends meet here, you know, go away for a few years. If you have a young family, you know, try and bring them obviously with you, UK, America, wherever you can do it. And then you can come back and live your dream in a few years. You might have to put your dream off for a while. And that's what I had to do.
And you never know really what your dream is. Very rarely do you have the dream packaged fully out of the box. You kind of might think this is the dream, but then you get there and it's why, you know, a lot of winners go broke, and a lot of entrepreneurs I meet, when they have the big exit, they go, yeah, I felt nothing. You know, sometimes you think your dream is one thing, but in reality, it's the journey. Where would you go today in the world if you were trying to like make it, in inverted commas? If you were talking to young Gary and you're like, right, let's go here and try and make it.
Yeah. Well, I actually live in Dubai. I've lived there for the last 3 years. And at the time, it was kind of a lifestyle thing. I wanted my kids to, you know, grow up in an environment where they could be out in the sun all the time. So that was my idea. But since then, I've realized that they're really forward thinking, and they have planned incredibly to triple the size of their economy in the next 25 years. So they're going from 10 million in the UAE to 30 million people. Now, if I was to say to you, Dublin is going to triple in size, or London's going to triple in size, you'd be like, I'm going. Like, you can be in building, you can be in education, whatever. It's just going to explode. And so parts of the world like that, and whatever other expanding economies there are. But I think that's kind of the current place. And they're giving visas away quite easily over there. You don't have to come in with a lot of money. You can get a tourist visa and extend it for a year and see how it goes. So I think currently, that's probably one of the fastest growing economies. It must be. It probably is the fastest growing economy in the world right now. So I think that's probably a place that I would go.
And I think if you want to have big change, you have to make big changes, right? You have to make the, you know, no one's going to knock on the door and go, here you go, Gary, here's your dream life packaged up in a nice bow. I think you have to have a little bit of friction, but like, it's only by exploring. and going beyond the comfort zone of like, oh, well, I can't do what my parents did.
Mm.
But you made the perfect point there. People went to London. We had a chat over coffee. America, like people went places to make something of themselves. Like we're a small economy.
Yeah, look, nothing worthwhile comes easy. And like in my generation, everyone was going off to the States and it was excitement. You know, people wanted to do it. I get that people want to be in Ireland now. I understand that. But if you really want to live your dream, maybe you just have to go away for a while. And maybe your dream should be make your money and come back here later. But like I said, generations of people had done that against their will and with their will. But you'll always be able to come back to Ireland. Ireland will always be my home. And I will probably come back and live here in a few years' time, 5-10 years, I'm not quite sure. And that's one of the great things about Ireland. We're one of those countries where when you're educated here, you can always come back. It always is like an anchor and things never change here. So I'd say to people, if they're kind of on the borderline, a lot of people actually phone me now and say, what's Dubai like? I'm thinking of coming. And I said, look, it's like standing on a cliff. But actually the fall isn't as great as you think it would be. Just jump. If you're thinking of going abroad, just do it. The worst that can happen is you can get a flight home.
I think it's a Buffett or a Munger quote. Most great quotes on the internet at this stage are, it's like, never be afraid of walking through a door you can walk back through again.
Sure.
It's like, beware of things that shut behind you, but never be afraid of going through a door that's open.
Sure. And with connectivity, like my kids talk to their grandparents all the time, face to face. So it's different. It's not like getting on a boat, you know, 50 years ago, going to Australia and you never see them again. That was incredibly sad. I don't see it as like we have moved and they're never coming back. I talk to my parents once, twice a week, just phone them, WhatsApp, you have messages with them, you chat to them. It's like you're still there.
It's the same. Well, my parents live in Tipperary, so like we FaceTime with my daughter most
same
days.
Distance.
So it's the same thing, right? It is. Yeah, it's the same thing.
It is, yeah. So a lot of the time it's kind of up here, you know, I'm moving.
What would you tell young Gary? So what advice would you give young Gary now with the benefit of hindsight through VidAid and going and living abroad? What advice would you give him?
I'd tell him absolutely nothing. Simply because, and I think I'll probably be the only person to say this, I was kind of born a lazy guy. And if someone had told me, and it was probably my extreme optimism, I would have said, it'll always work out. But I had to fail a lot for me to realize it's not going to work out and I need to pull myself out of this. So if I was to go back and say, listen, it's all going to be fine, you're going to do A, B, and C, I wouldn't end up doing it. So
you need that fear.
So older Gary can't say a thing. Nothing, not a word.
It's funny, I have that feeling. I was at a conference last week and I find them quite difficult because you don't know anyone. You're just thrown around a table and you have to make that small talk. And I got kind of deeply talking to this guy and we're on kind of a similar path. He wants to do like this big software business, but software as a product. And we're on kind of, and I said, look, I'm doing the podcast and I just know it's going to work out. I can't tell you exactly. It's like when you have blurry vision. So I wear glasses and you know, your vision's a bit blurry. It's like when you're like, I know it's there, can't see it yet, but it's just around the corner. I think all entrepreneurs have that belief, but then you do get that gut feeling.
Mm-hmm.
At what point in VidHid did you get that feeling or did you?
Oh yeah, I got it from day one. Well, I think I was always very optimistic and I've often looked back on it because I'm a dad now and I start to think, you know, how can I influence my kids to be positive? And my little girl sat in my lap the other day and we were in the car and she's 6 and she said to me, oh, I'll have a problem driving. And I said, why? And she was like, oh, I don't know if I'll ever be able to drive. So I said, never think like that. You can do absolutely anything. So every day I'm told that. My parents used to tell me that all the time. They were both entrepreneurs. And someone said to me one day, gosh, it was a really big thing for you to start your own business. And I said, no, it would have been a really big thing for me to do accountancy exams or biology exams because I wasn't built that way. I, you know, if someone gave me an answer A or B, I'd probably pick toaster. I wasn't good at exams, right? I just, my short-term memory is appalling and still is to this day. So I couldn't go that route. But my optimism has probably come from a little bit of sporting success when I was younger. I played a reasonably high level of rugby and I just had that attitude that if you train harder and you want it bad enough and you want it more than anybody else, then you'll succeed. And probably backed up with my parents as well. And actually the third thing, which people don't often talk about enough, is your friend group. So I was probably the last in my friend group of maybe 7-8 people to show moderate success financially. It took me a much longer time. So they're all top solicitors, oil traders. One guy is a CEO of a $6 billion company. And we were just random school guys that all went to school in Rathmines. And I'm not sure which one of them was more successful first, but it's almost like a subconscious thing. When all of your friends are going somewhere, you want to get there too. So I suppose I kind of never gave up. So there's a few different influences, but I definitely believe that you can influence people to get that entrepreneurial spirit. Like, and finally, you know, my kid wants to climb a tree. I'm like, yeah, go higher, you know, as opposed to saying, you know, you could fall.
So careful. I think you need don't to say those words. Careful. Because that doesn't mean anything.
It's the worst thing you can say to a kid.
Careful. I believe, yeah. I do too. My daughter's only 18 months and they're having sports day in creche today. So I was giving her a pep talk in the kitchen in the morning. And my wife's like, I don't think it's that serious, Gary. I was like, no, but like, it's all about like instilling confidence in her as a human. I don't really care what she does. Goes to college, does her own business, whatever she wants to do. But it's just as long as she's confident, happy, and tries.
And here's a question. Did everybody get a medal?
No one got medals. I know. And I was like, I hope she comes home with like a medal. I'm checking the app during the day going, is she on the podium yet?
I have a serious problem with all kids getting medals. Same. And simply because, so the odd time, you know, I'd be playing snakes and ladders with my daughter, for instance, and I consciously try and win like one in every two or one in every three, and it annoys her. And she's like, why are you being so mean? I'm going, no, you lose. Like life, you lose more than you win. So we all want the best for our kids and we all go, oh, sure, I'll let you win at certain times. But if you continually do that and kids don't learn to lose, you're going to go through a lot of issues in later life when you actually do lose, you know.
But it's so abrasive and so devastating then when they have a loss older. Whereas if you have micro exposure to losses along the way.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Definitely builds a more rounded human. Like I think, you know, as an entrepreneur, you're going to lose all the time. Every single day. And if you have that fear, you're never going to do anything.
Yeah. But the thing about entrepreneurship is you can lose 100 times. You only need to win once.
Someone said that. You only need to get rich once, Gary. And I was like, that's a good point.
And then don't give it away because you've learned previously. Yeah.
You've kind of triggered something in my head there. What's your ultimate personal goal? Forget FitHit. Like, what's your personal goal beyond kind of like your family and everything being healthy? What's Gary's goal for Gary?
It sounds a bit cheesy, but I'm kind of living my personal goal. And I think that's a good place to be in because I went through so much stress and heartache for so many years between early 2000 through to, let's say, 2010, 2011, that I genuinely wake up most days and pinch myself and go, I can't believe this has happened. I am very happy with where I am. And I said to my wife recently, I said, gosh, you know, if I was ever to like win the lottery or whatever, I don't think my life would change that much because sure, you might do something stupid like buy a boat or something, but everyday life, I've got a really healthy family. We live in a nice part of the world. My business is going very well and it's growing. I don't know what else I want. So I think as well, when you're going through a journey, a lot of the time you don't stop to smell the roses and I'm currently doing that at the moment. And it doesn't mean I'm stopping, we're still growing. But to answer the question, yeah, I'm very happy where I am. There's not a lot that I want to achieve at the moment, except for make the company bigger and take over the world. But
well, that's why I asked you the personal thing, because I'm kind of fascinated by this at the minute because so many entrepreneurs I've chatted to just don't seem very happy.
Yeah.
They just don't, and it makes me unhappy to hear them in that way, because even on paper you should be looking at them going, oh, you know, they've had an exit or they're doing really well. And I chat to them and I kind of delve into them and I try to explore the body, the business and the brain, and I've literally had someone say to me going, don't ask me about the body or the brain, I do nothing there. I'm like, Jesus.
But they're the highly successful guys, the guys that wake up in the morning and live to work. And I work to live. That's the difference.
It depends how you define success.
Yeah. So you can't switch that off. So when you are really, really highly motivated every day for 20 years and suddenly you get an exit and you're making, so like some of the guys you'd be interviewing might be worth 30, 40, 50 million, whatever. They can't switch it off. So they can't suddenly relax. They want to do it again and again and again because that's what motivates them. I think for me, I was motivated by fear. My most productive times was when I was in serious trouble and someone was repossessing my house, repossessing my car, and I just focused on the business and I was getting in my car and I drove around to 3,500 stores in a year and a half and sold it into pretty much every one of them. And that was when I was laser focused, because
I tell people that story all the time.
By fear.
If I remember chatting to early stage food and drink entrepreneurs, I reference back to your episode. I tell them that exact story because people are like, oh, I just can't seem to grow. I can't seem to get a place. I'm like, have you done this?
Yeah, exactly.
Because until you've done that, I wouldn't, you know, sound 100%. The alarm bells yet, unless you're willing to go door to door, talk to people. I think people have this expectation it's going to be a lot easier than it is.
Well, I advise three or four different companies, and I do pro bono because I don't want people to suffer with the way I did. And the chances are they are, right? People in our business, it's a huge failure rate. And I always say to them, how many stores are you in? And I'll write it on a piece of paper and they'll answer and I'll go, and they say 200 and I've got 200 written down. And I say, get off your effing ass, get into your car and double that sales. If you double that sales, you get 10 a week, you know, it's going to take you a very small amount of time to actually, in 3 or 4 months' time, you're going to have to double the size of your company. Would you like to double the size of your company? Well, yeah. Well, then get into another 200 stores. It's not that difficult. And I call it the business version of skipping leg day. You know, you're basically, which I've skipped leg day for 25 years, by the way. That's why I wear long pants all the time. But people naturally don't want to sell. I didn't want to sell. I didn't want to go from store to store, harassing some manager saying, please take my drinks. But when I was going broke, I had to do it. So it forced me into like a massive failure. And that's how I was motivated. I could hardly afford to put petrol in the car to actually get around the place. And my house had gone. So the only thing I could do was get into stores. And guess what? I went from the company being insolvent to a very successful brand within the space of like 18 months just by selling it in. It makes so much sense, but people don't want to do it.
Why?
I think even though we're Irish, we're great in a pub or a restaurant, but we are always embarrassed to sell to people. You know, Americans are kind of born to sell. They'll sell you anything and they're like super enthusiastic about it. We're just a bit cynical. So I think I used to sit outside, stores. And I'd say to myself, right, do one thing every day that scares you. And I'd push myself into it because I don't know, it was weird. And I often say to people, oh, I used to have a bit of a phobia about selling. And they're like, but how, like, you're the biggest salesman I know. But yeah, I'll always chat to people and it seems like sales. But when you're actually told, go sell that, it's a lot more difficult. I think as a nation, we're quite cynical and we kind of just go into ourselves and go, oh God, it's a bit embarrassing going in the sound of that guy. But you know, it's your life. You got to do it. And what I realized is that the manager's job is to actually receive your sales. So once I started going into them and talking to them, you get the odd rude guy who's having a bad day or whatever, and that does hurt and it kind of makes you go into yourself a little bit. But once you start getting going, I ended up loving it. I loved sales. You know, you just got to push yourself out. And again, on your cliff and just push yourself off the cliff and suddenly you'll double the size of your company in 2 or 3 months. That's not a bad thing.
It's mad. Like if you could tell someone that going, if you just do this, every day for a year, you'll double the size of your company. They do anything.
Yeah.
But they won't do that unforced. I think we really need to kind of like reshape how we think about things a little bit in Ireland, because there is that kind of like hesitancy. I think you've summed it up perfectly there. We're great crack. Great to have the chats.
Yeah.
But when it comes to going,
don't try and sell me anything.
Oh, and will you take this then? Oh, no. Yeah. But it's mad because I was talking someone about this last week, like you're generally one connection away in Ireland. You know, in America it's like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, you're 6 degrees away from the place you want to be. In Ireland it's generally one.
Yeah, and that's an amazing tool, LinkedIn, which certainly wasn't around.
Unbelievable. Like, people hate it, I love it.
Oh, I absolutely love it. I've been in the business a long time and you get to know more people, but I've never been that corporate guy at the top of Coca-Cola and I can phone up the top of Tesco and that kind of stuff. But what I would always do is if we really want to get into a country, and let's say I want to get into Norway, for instance, we just got in there recently. I would contact my distributor. I'd look at LinkedIn and I'd find the company I want to get to and I'd see who they know. And then I will contact the people that they know and say, listen, can you introduce me to him? I mean, it's fantastic. It's all sitting there right in front of you.
It's wild. People just don't use it. I think touching back on your previous point, they're kind of afraid to use it because they think it's a bit cringe. And you're like, Not really. Like, where else can you reach that dedicated audience? You're not going to have to pay.
I know.
You're not going to have to go to a conference and wander around trying to find them and rely on serendipity. You literally can in-mail anyone in the world. And I keep saying this to especially early stage entrepreneurs and students. I'm like, it's probably the only social media the business owner must still control.
Yeah.
They'll probably outsource Instagram. They'll probably outsource Twitter. Definitely outsource TikTok. It's the only one you directly, bar maybe their inbox, but the PA might have that. They won't outsource LinkedIn because it's kind of like personal. Mm. There's a lot of business things that go on and they might get a new job through there.
Sure.
It's the one thing they keep hold of.
Now, the downside to that is I get contacted on LinkedIn. Oh my God. I'd say 10 a day with Instagram targeting companies, Amazon targeting companies. So I would say to any business out there, if the man and his dog is doing the business, don't get into that business. Like, I remember saying 8 years ago when we started to really ramp up our social media, we don't know what to do here. Who do we go to? And we ended up paying a company way too much money. Now, we all do it in-house now. But back then was a great time to start up a social media company. Please don't do a social media company. Now, there's just too many. So go into the business that nobody else is doing. So, you know, whiskey companies, there's so many of them now. You've probably had a few in the past, sorry.
But I agree. I'm laughing because I agree
with
you.
Maybe we can cut that bit out. But
no, we won't, because it's a great point. Like, you know, during COVID, I think every county had a distillery or a brewery there for a while.
Mm.
That doesn't make any sense.
No. And, you know, there's obviously going to be the odd success in the US and, you know, selling the Irish Dream over in America and whiskey and all that kind of stuff. But there's going to be a lot of failures in that business. And actually my business now is becoming an area which has a low barrier. You don't need much knowledge, but you do need a bit of cash now to start it. So there are a lot of incumbents coming in the UK and in the US. It's a huge failure rate. But, you know, so I would say if everybody's in the business, don't go into that business. Try and find something that hardly anybody is in.
What would you do in 2024? Going to put you on the spot now. Gary's starting in 2024. You don't have your contacts. You don't have your money. You don't have the brand. Mm. You're like, right, I'm going to do something this year. You can circle back on this in a while.
Yeah.
But have a think of what business would you start in 2024?
Well, I'll still probably come up with the same answer. So obviously you need capital to do something. So what I would do is I'd walk around my local Tesco and I would find anything that isn't being currently challenged. So whether it's Ariel, Fairy Liquid, something like that. Toilet paper was done recently. The company that's doing millions called Who Gives a Crap, and they basically use bamboo, which is eminently more recyclable than the paper that they're using. So that one's done. But I would go around, I'd look at dog food. I think that's done a lot. But I'd find something on the shelves in Tesco. If you gave me like an hour, I'd find something.
Would you do food and drink again?
Oh, yeah.
Would you?
Yeah, definitely. Well, on my phone, I'm a typical bloke. I'm a one-trick pony. I have to focus on one thing. So Vithit is it. And we grow at around 25% a year for the last 10 years. So, nothing else is going to do that, right?
Yeah.
But if I was ever out of Vithit, I have a list of things in FMCG and food and drink that I would get into. And it's just, for me, I think it's great to challenge these really big, slow, monolithic companies. Like, you know, I'm still challenging Coca-Cola and Britvic and LucasAid and those guys because they can't shuffle as fast as I can. And it's harder for them to create a brand because if you tell Coke, for instance, to come up with a new kombucha drink or a new vitamin drink, you're going to have someone in that company who isn't personally linked to it. So they will basically have somebody who's making a wage and who'll probably leave the company in 4 years. So they'll start it up and they'll be, you know, into it and it'll be their project. And then suddenly they'll leave. Someone else has to carry the baggage. And then it's not turning over what it should, which my company wasn't for 11 years. And it'll be cut out and because it's the last and the dying herd and it'll be attacked. And then there'll be another new project and another new person coming in. So you don't have that real need and desire to succeed within those companies. And that's why individuals have a shot at taking on those big guys.
Would you sell Vithit?
Yeah, I'm not completely against it. So if you look at the top 30 to 40 Irish drinks companies, we're the only one in the top 30, I think, and we're number 7 best-selling drink in Ireland. And in the UK, we're the number 1 functional drink. So I kind of like those stats, and I want to... So Vivid is a very well-selling, very high-selling product in Ireland, and it's growing at a serious pace in the UK. So I want to create that same model in pretty much every country around Europe. I want to do it in France, I want to do it in Switzerland, et cetera, et cetera. So my job's not done here. Even though we're 25 years old, we're really still only a challenger brand. We're only getting going. So the accelerator is really moving now. Mm-hmm. So if you're moving at 25% a year, 10 years ago, it's a much smaller amount from compounding than it is today. So let's say 25% of a million is 1.25, but 25% of 30 million, I'm no mathematician, but it's a lot bigger. So that's kind of where we are now. So we're really growing at a very fast pace now. And that's exciting for me. You know, obviously you have to look at your family. I'm 53 now. And if anyone came in with a stupid offer, I would have to listen, but it's not currently on our agenda.
Hmm. It kind of feels like this is your time. Like me and Ben were chatting about this earlier. Like just there's a movement. There's two extremes, right? And we chatted about this briefly as well about food. You know, there's two extremes to like really healthy and really unhealthy. And it seems the middle is kind of disappearing. Mm. Like if you come to our house, it's either sparkling water, milk, or Vitit. Mm. They're the only three things in our house. We don't have soft drinks. Like we're super healthy. And it kind of feels like now is the time for Vitit. Like, whereas before it was only super healthy people, whereas now it's much broader because people are much more into their health. Like, yeah. So it kind of feels like now is the time.
Yeah, well, I deliberately designed it that way that it would be easy for people to move away from unhealthy drinks to healthy drinks. So I spent about a year to a year and a half on each drink, because I want it to taste just as good as Coca-Cola, Lucozade or whatever. So if someone takes a Vitit one day and they're like, oh, it's, you know, you're going to think, oh, it's not going to taste great because it's healthy. And you go, oh, wow, that tastes just as good as my sugary drink. Then you have them for life.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing. I always wanted it to be mainstream. I never wanted it to be in the back of the store. And the other thing was, I'm not sure whether when I lost money for 11 years is because I just didn't know what I was doing or the country wasn't ready for it. You know, if you think back, so I went to Australia to live for a year back in 1990, and I was playing rugby down there and working on a building site. And I remember specifically I'd come home in the morning at 5 a.m. from the building site, or was it the nightclub? I can't quite remember. But I remember going down by the Brisbane River and people would be jogging into work. And I'd never seen that before. That just didn't happen in Ireland. Nobody went out in the morning and jogged. And now you see it. You go to Sandyman Strand or any strand in Ireland and you see them in the morning and there's hundreds of people out jogging and staying fit. So there is now, fitness and health is now a mainstream thing. And then look, you could get on to the obesity issues. I have my opinions about all that. But the basic premise behind Vitit was, why would you take something that has 28 grams of sugar, which is going to make you fat, or you take something like this, which is only 6 grams of sugar? So you're saving yourself 75% of the sugar intake in a day. Like, why would you go for the sugar option? And people are kind of, it's now mainstream. People are kind of getting it more and more now.
Mm. It's interesting because we kind of talked about this earlier, but like people don't really get it. I think they don't kind of understand 28 grams of sugar. Kind of shrug their shoulders and on they go. Mm. Whereas when you see it like this and you package it up, you kind of go, okay, that, no mathematician, like you said, but that's a lot. That's a huge difference.
Yeah. If I was to do one thing, to educate kids in this country, because we have a serious obesity epidemic here. You just see it when you land and you're abroad for a while and you see it and it's quite shocking. And if I was to just teach people one thing, it'd be just how to read a label. And just remember this, your kids can only process 15 grams of sugar a day. Mm. The average bottle of Lucozade contains 28 grams of sugar.
Jesus.
So if you just remember that, and you can only process 20 grams of sugar a day. So if you just remember that, just that basic premise. So everything from that point onwards, whether it's a chocolate biscuit or a muffin or a little treat for your kid. And if you're wondering why your kid has a weight problem, or if you have a weight problem or anything like that, that's the first thing that you can do, is just cut down your sugar. It's so important. Mm. And it's the main reason why we have such obesity problems in Europe right now, is that snacking of available sugar things. We're never hungry anymore. You know, we used to have 3 meals a day, breakfast, lunch and dinner. Now it's probably 8 meals because you're taking chocolate bars and you're taking protein bars and you're never giving your body a rest. So that's the other thing I would do. I'd stick to 3 meals a day so your body can kind of go into that fasting area. So sugar and 3 meals.
Yeah, you go into a shop and it's literally stuffed to the gills with sweets, sugar, snacks, and they're all packaged up. And there's so many like high protein, low fat, low sugar, low carb. And you're like, you can see how people get confused. Even if they're trying to make the good decision, you can see how they're kind of like baited and switched with all these kind of like healthy products. If it's in a package, you know, it's been processed.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how you look at it, like, you know, whereas like you go in, you're trying like, I'm going to get a healthy snack. Very few shops, you have to really look for it.
Yeah. And by the way, sugar is highly addictive. There's a lot of tests that say it's as addictive as cocaine. And I know this because years ago, oh gosh, it was like 25 years ago, I went to a personal trainer and he said to me, he said, look, there's this new thing called keto diets. He said, you just give up sugar. And I said, I can do that, no problem. And I had no idea how much sugar I was taking every day. And I'll never forget it. I went to him at like 10 o'clock in the morning and by 8 o'clock at night, I was having sugar sweats. I really needed sugar. So I went down to my local shop and I bought a packet of Jaffa cakes and I emptied them into my mouth. And I was like, I am a sugar addict. And I never knew, because it's just something that is just percolates into your life over years.
But it's in everything. It's in everything. If you go and you're doing your weekly shop, and we're going on a rant here, but we'll rant a little bit. If you do your weekly shop and you're looking around, if you look at sauces or anything of really good that you add to your food, full of sugar. The second ingredient, like you read the label and the second ingredient is nearly always sugar.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I wonder why a sauce tastes so good when I buy it or when I have it in a restaurant. Whereas when you make your own sauce at home, if you literally, you wouldn't be scooping in 6 tablespoons of sugar, she'd be like, geez, that's really unhealthy.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's hidden in everything.
Yeah. Well, a really simple thing, and I have no affiliation with them whatsoever. There's an app called MyFitnessPal.
Use it every day.
It's incredible. And, you know, because people are often confused by this. They're confused by the amount of sugar in your tea and how much sugar do I need and blah, blah, blah. So if you don't want to stick to the 15 to 20 grams of sugar a day, just put everything you have into MyFitnessPal. It's unbelievable. I have friends who have lost a lot of weight and got really healthy by just going through that and going, you know, sure, I eat sausages every Saturday, and you look at it and go, oh my God, there's 350 calories in a sausage or whatever it is. Then they go, well, no.
It's not about fear. It's just about education.
Yeah, it's completely.
When I say to people, people are like, oh, I can't get fit. I can't get healthy. I'm like, okay, don't worry about it. Like, so park that. Just go for a walk once a day. The rest of the time, just track your food for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't believe I was eating that much, or I can't believe I was eating this much sugar.
It's incredible.
If you just literally log your food for 2 weeks, you will be blown away by what you eat.
Yeah, yet again, technology can help you that way.
But you literally can scan the packet. It's an incredible app.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
So talk to me then about FitHit. We had a question in, I put it up on Instagram yesterday, you're coming on, we got a good few questions. A question from Owen was like, how do you choose where to expand into and how do you do it?
Well, it used to be whoever would take us.
You know, I love the honesty.
Yeah, when you're starting, if you get, you know, one man in a truck who's going to take your product, you'll just give it to him and let him sell it wherever. We're a lot more choosy now because there's a thing called a grey market, which means, you know, you could be selling to the UK. If you sell to the wrong guy, he'll sell it into Ireland, you know, underpriced, and you can kind of mess your whole distribution model up. But now we go to European trade shows and we've got, let's say, 14 to 16 countries, depending on the time of year you're asking me, around the world. And you could have a guy coming, and let's say we're not in France, and he says, look, I'd really like to take this into France. And then you just do a bit of research on him and you say, well, you know, what other brands do you have? And if he doesn't have any brands that we would aspire to, whether it be in confectionery, like Tony's Chocolate Only is a really cool brand, or Oatly or something like that, then we wouldn't do business with them. But then sometimes you have these companies that are really big and have all those brands and don't pay any attention to you. So I still have problems to this day. Like there's a country up in Northern Europe that I'm trying to get at the moment. And I'm contacting people through LinkedIn, et cetera, et cetera. And even at the level we're at, which is a private company is doing very well, they still wouldn't meet with me and they, you know, you get ignored. So like years ago, I'd get ignored by the shop owner. Now I'm getting ignored by distributors and retailers, but it's people still ignoring me. I still have to sell.
I think it's important to factor that in, because I think people will listen to this and go, nah, it's easy for Gary, isn't it? Because he's got a world famous brand. Yeah. But I think it's important to note that you still have
still
to
getting
work.
Ignored.
Still get ignored, yeah. Like just on different levels.
Oh, getting ignored a lot. I mean, I'm always contacting new countries and new companies and whatever, and I'd say 80 to 90% of them never email me back.
Mm.
So, you know, you just got to take it on the chin and just keep going.
Just got to graft. You mentioned something there about distributing. Is that how it works? So if you have an Irish brand, you're like want to distribute into like Belgium, Sweden, France, whatever. Is that how it works? You find someone, a partner in that country, they'll just send it out for you?
Yeah, yeah. So, and if you can't find a good distributor, so let's say a distributor will take a percentage. So they might take 25 to 30%. So your percentage model needs to be squeezed a little bit. And if you're in FMCG, if you're not making, you know, 35 to 40%, then it's your business model isn't going to work because you need to have huge multiples because, you know, you're only selling these for 60, 70 cent to a distributor and then he makes the margin, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a difficult market, but, you know, so the UK was a very interesting one. We tried two distributors in the UK and both of them failed. And eventually we were like, we're going to have to do this ourselves. So it's not something that we want to do. It's not part of our business model.
Why did they fail? When you say fail, why what didn't work?
It's hard to say. I'm not sure whether the UK is such a big market, 10 times the size of Ireland, that I think that any of the large successful companies were too small for them back in the day. So they just wouldn't even pay your attention. If they're making 10 million quid a year out of something, why would they make 200 grand out of us, you know? So we didn't really wait to find out. We just, I hired one guy and I basically hired him the keys to the city. And I said, his name is Ryan. He's still with us today. He's a commercial director now in the UK. And I just said, listen, you run this. I had got us Tesco and Tesco Boots. And then he came in and he got us Sainsbury's, WH Smith, and we're in Co-op and we're most stores around the UK now. But he's been running it for the last 11 years. And we did that because we had to do it. We also did that in Australia. Because again, distributors model didn't work there. We don't want to do it. We don't want to be hiring people ourselves to do a job that someone else could do. Mm. Our business model is to create a brand, sell it to somebody. We'll back it up with marketing and online sales to create a kind of a buzz and do some tastings in the country. And then they'll deliver to the stores.
Right.
And then the store will sell it.
Okay. So that kind of keeps the model quite lean, even for a big business. You're not putting in HQs in every single office,
sure,
place you go to.
Yeah, and we still only have 30 people in the business.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Mm.
So yeah, you run quite a tight ship.
Yeah, and this year we'll sell 50 million bottles. Yeah, so we try and keep it as tight as possible, yeah.
That's incredible. Mm. And can't even run the maths on how many bottles per person. A lot.
A lot, yeah.
So how have you managed then kind of like moving away, inverted commas, like how, because I think a lot of people are struggling when I talk to like entrepreneurs, they're like, the distributed workforce is hard, the hybrid work model is hard. Like how are you working that from being abroad yourself and then kind of the new world we live in?
So we hadn't planned this question, but there's a little bit of a long answer here. Which
we don't plan any questions, Gary. Yeah. Don't give away the secrets.
It's off the hoof. So back in the day when things were running very thin for me, I approached a guy and he approached me. Someone very close to me approached me and said, your business is in trouble, isn't it? And I said, no. You know, what's giving you that impression? He said, well, the fact your bins are piling up outside your house and I couldn't pay my bin tax. And he said, I know you're in trouble. And
no
I was
way.
And I was like, yeah, I'm in serious trouble. And he said, okay, what do you need? And he opened his checkbook and I wrote down, I said, I don't want, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't want to take money from you. And he convinced me. And he wrote down a number and I said, yeah, that would do it. So he got a percentage of the company. So then take that and put that to one side. And then about 4 years ago, my brother, who's a successful oil trader, the algorithm started beating his trades. So he, at the age of 50, went back to college and did an MBA with three kids under the age of 18. So the most expensive time in his life. So he came out of college and he was 5 months without a job. And not because he wasn't intelligent enough, but, you know, who wants to hire a 50-year-old who's never been in whatever business that he wanted to get into? So I was in a bar one night and my friend, who's a highly successful guy, turns to me and he says, you're some effing idiot. And I'm like, what? And he said, Troy, my brother, is the sharpest guy in the room. And he said, you know, why don't you hire him? So he is now our CEO And he was the guy who gave me the money all those years ago.
No way.
Yeah. So amazing how things come in full circle.
What a, also, what a cool job. Oil trader.
Yeah.
That's something you don't hear too often.
I know, I know. I still don't know what he did, but it was just oil trading.
Yeah. It sounds sense.
Now he's, so to bring it back to your original question, he is now the CEO of the company. He runs the day to day. He's the engine of the company. He surrounds himself with, you know, accountants and logistics people. And he's got this whole, he's a lot more linear than I am. So he's got this whole mechanism running. So if I was to get hit by a bus tomorrow, the company would still be going perfect. Just don't want him to get hit by a bus. He's the most important person.
Troy's the key man risk.
He's the most important person now.
How did he become CEO though? Did you want to give up the CEO role? Was that something you're thinking about? Or is this like he came in, you're like, okay, now this
well, he came in as a consultant at the start. And then at some stage, you just have to get out of your own way. I mean, I'm the creative one. And I think one of my biggest skills is knowing my weaknesses. You know, I'm good at sales and I'm good at creating. And all of that logistics stuff and accounting stuff, my head just explodes. I literally can't do it. So you have to surround yourself with people who do jobs that you cannot do.
Hmm.
And if you're kind of an accountant type person, hire a creative. If you're a creative person, hire an accountant type person. They're the first two that can run a company like this. And, yeah, just over time, I could see he really knew what he was talking about. And I just kind of started stepping back and letting him do more and more of the daytime. And then I'm like, well, you're actually much better than me at doing this kind of stuff. And I'll stay doing what I'm good at. So, you know, and positions and titles don't mean anything to me. So I just have founder down there now. He's CEO, founder. I don't care what it says, even if it's non-founder or, you know, executive director, whatever. It doesn't bother me. That doesn't matter to me. And he runs the day-to-day engine of it. And I do things like product creation. I'll fly into countries and, you know, try and schmooze the distributors and get them to buy more and, you know, or try and get them to list our product and that kind of stuff. So I do all the stuff which I really enjoy. But I mean, when you think about it, if you're doing something for 25 years, you are going to get a certain burnout in various different areas. So he's energized because he's only been in the company, you know, 4 or 5 years. And I'm energized because I'm doing things that I like to do.
Yeah. That's really interesting because you do see so many founders just walk away after a certain period of time, especially like it kind of feels, like I said already, it kind of feels like Vidhit's entering a sweet spot. I think a lot of founders probably 4 or 5 years ago, when you reached that stage, probably would have went, oh, I'll just sell it and delegs it early. Mm. Or it's really interesting to see the injection of fresh blood. It's also really interesting about Troy. You know, it's like that cliche, you know, you ask a fish to climb a tree.
Mm.
It's the dumbest fish in the world, whereas you ask a fish to swim in the ocean, no problem.
Yeah.
It's finding your fit.
Yeah.
Like on paper, super hyper intelligent guy, oil trader, MBA.
Mm.
He should have walked into any job he wanted.
Correct.
But it's often trying to find that fit is really difficult.
Yeah. And actually the week I offered him the job, he had just been offered a job. So he was kind of jobless for, let's say, I don't know, 3 to 5 months, something like that. And he'd just been, and so he genuinely had to think about it. He was kind of like, oh God, you know, I've been offered this really, and at the time it was a really good job. I haven't asked him actually, should he have taken the other job?
Do you regret that, Troy? We'll get Troy on and do like the alter ego side.
Yeah.
What was it like though, stepping away? Did you have any, I know you said you don't really care. Like, was it weird?
No, not in the slightest.
And was it weird working with your brother?
Not in the slightest. My wife actually is our head of marketing, and it sounds like a very nepotistic company,
it
but
really does. It's a family affair. Play the theme tune.
I know, but you know what? Everybody is highly qualified in what they do. So my wife, when I met her, she was national brand manager for Jägermeister and Corona. And one day I said to her, listen, we need some marketing. We're going to hire a marketing company. Why don't you just come and work with us? And she was like, oh, I don't really want to work with my husband. I said, I don't want to work with my wife. You'll work in the office and I'll work from the car. So I don't work from an office. I never have. It's just not my thing. So I like to be out and about.
Yeah.
So, from that day onwards, we don't really work together, even though we work under the same brand. You know,
I think that's really interesting because a lot of people now, kind of, we keep talking about the new world, but I think a lot of people are now kind of going, maybe we want freedom. If we want freedom, we kind of have to do our own thing. So they kind of really realize that, well, the obvious answer is in the room. You're really talented at this. I'm really talented at that. Maybe we could do something together. Me and my wife have this debate all the time. We're complete polar opposites. Sound exactly like you and your wife.
Yep.
I'm very kind of like, exactly like you. Don't want to be in an office. Don't want to be sitting down. I have all these ideas. We were having that conversation on the car on the way in. I was like, okay, I want you to talk about this. And she starts giving me the logical linear approach. I'm like, no. Let's just creatively. Yeah. Let's just think about anything possible. And she goes, well, logically, I'm like, no, forget it. We just couldn't have the conversation.
No, you
can't. She's so logical and linear.
No, you can have it with me. Don't have it with your wife.
Yeah. So what's next for Vithit? Like, you keep growing and growing and growing and expanding. And I keep going back to a sweet spot moment for Vithit. Like, what do you think is next? Like, what do you think could happen with Vithit?
We want to get to 100 million bottles a year. That's our goal. We want to do that within 3 years. We'll probably hopefully do it within 2.5. That's pretty much our goal. So we want to double the size of the company within that time. The UK is really where it's at for us at the moment. That's growing. Like, last year it grew at 40%, the year before 45%. This year already it's up 26%. So the UK, if you look at the UK, there's probably 35,000 to 40,000 stores, and we're probably only in about 8,000 of them. And our rate of sale is really very strong. So
what does rate of sale mean?
So rate of sale is, if you have a mug and you sell one mug per week in a store, and if you have a bottle of Vithit and you're selling 18 units of this per store, that's your rate of sale. So Ireland, because we're a mature product in this market and we're the 7th best selling product in the country, our rate of sale is naturally very high. And in the UK, we expect it to be a little bit lower, but actually it's just as high, if not higher, in the UK. So we just need to get into more stores.
Okay. Now, if so, you know the model's working, you know the playbook's strong, you just need to get more volume 100%.
Through the stores. So if I was Coca-Cola or Britvic in the UK, I could probably multiply the sales by about 4x overnight, just by getting it into more stores. Because we know it sells in Sainsbury's, it sells in Tesco, it sells in Boots, but we're not in all of those. We're only in, like, let's say, 30-40% of those stores. So, you know, instead of being in 1,000 co-op, you want to be in 3,000 co-op. Instead of being in a, 1,000 Tesco, you want to be in 4,000 Tesco, whatever the amount of stores there are. So, and that's a really important point, because in our business, the most important thing is rate of sale. And lots of companies will start and they'll give you the whole dog and pony show, and they'll say, look, packaging is amazing. It's sparkling water mixed with, no sugar, whatever they'll do. And they'll have great branding. But then you stick it on the shelf. If it doesn't sell, it is going to fail. Over time, there's no amount of financing is going to fix it. It will fail. And that's the one great thing about that we have here. And it's why we've survived. We put it into any country, zero marketing. We stick it on the shelf in Australia. We did 3 million bottles last year. In Australia, and it's just one of those products that you put it there and people just get it. I don't have to explain what Vithit does. And I think that's a really important packaging part.
I was going to ask you, what is that? Because even when I look across the table and I can see the bottle in front of me, like, obviously I drink it all the time, so I already know. But if I was trying to look at it from fresh eyes there, I'm like, what is it? Because it's part art, part science, I'd imagine.
Science.
Why do people get it? Like, is it part art, part sciences? Is it like
touch and feel? So basically, it sounds really simple, but I'm a really simple creature. So it's got to look great, taste great, and be great. So a product doesn't look great. So I'll give you the example. So back in the early 2000s, when I first created this, it was a completely different pack, and it was called Vitz, V-I-T-Z. It didn't sell a bottle. And that's where I started losing money. And I remember being outside a cinema and I was totally distraught. And I was saying, oh my God, like, this product isn't selling. What am I going to do? I know the product inside it is really good. And I went to this college and I did some research and I sat at the back, and the college kids thought it was German because it said V-I-T-Z. They thought it said Weitz. So I was like an aha moment. So I took 3 weeks, woke up every night, wrote down all the notes, and eventually I came up with the name Vithit, and I registered on vithit.com, on register.com. I think it was probably 2005, let's say. And I registered it. And from that point onwards, once it said Vithit, sales went up by 100% overnight.
Wow.
And then from that point, then we were in an ugly looking skinny bottle. And then the following year, we got this packaging here. So actually, there's another interesting story if we have time.
Yeah, of course.
So when I went to my graphic designer, who I'd found through a friend of mine, I basically said to him, I said, look, I've got this nice new bottle, what you call a wide mouth bottle. And like the pubs, so in pubs, you'll have skinny mouth bottle 28 mil, and this is the wide mouth bottle. So this was kind of relatively new back in 2005. So I said, look, I've got this bottle, completely clean slate. I said, I've got the brand name Vithit, I've registered it. I'd like to have some sort of a target, so, hit. But I said, you go to the designer and go do what you want. So we came back with this blackboard of 6 different labels on it. And I walked into a studio and I looked at them, and it was 1, 2, and they were flat labels. And I saw them and I said, I'm really sorry, none of them are going to work. I said, I just don't like the look of it. So I was actually walking out the door and I said, just give me a second, I'll go down and I'll get the bottle. So I ran down to the car, got the bottle, filled it up, and I ripped off the label off the blackboard and I stuck it onto the bottle. And that is that label that you see today. And once I saw it, I was literally like, oh my God, I nearly missed it.
So flat, it just didn't...
Just didn't pop. Mm. And then once I stuck it on the bottle, I was like, that's perfect. Give me five flavors of that, we're done. And from that point on, we really haven't changed anything in the label. So if it ain't broke, don't try to fix it. We don't touch our labels now. So getting back to the point, if it looks good, which it now does, and looks healthy because it's got white and bright colors, and if it tastes good as number two, so many people go out with products that don't taste great. I spend a year on every different flavor of this, just getting the flavor just right. And then three, if it isn't actually good. So, you know, you could drink this three times, and then you're sitting down for lunch, you start to read the back of it, and you look at the ingredients. If the ingredients aren't healthy, then you're gone, and you'll, you know. So that's how we build a brand. It's those three things. They're very hard to get together, because most of the time, my product was great inside that ugly pack, but no one would buy it off the shelf because it was an ugly pack.
And it sounds so obvious, even obvious to go, look, it tastes great, be great. Like, it's easier said than done, but I think probably there is compromise on some of those factors when you're just trying to get it out the door.
Well, again, if you take it back, if you're Coca-Cola, Britvic, or Lucozade, and you say, we really want to create the next kombucha or whatever, and you have a guy who's working for the company, I lost money and the product didn't sell for 5 years. The guy who probably sets it up in those companies has probably gone out of the company. And I really cared because it was my life. You know, I wouldn't be able to pay my mortgage without it. So I had to change because I was invested. I had to tweak the flavors. I had to do all that kind of stuff, get the packaging right. Suddenly, bang, it works. But if that wouldn't make it that long in another company because the sales are so bad that they would just get canned.
That's really important to remember that as well. As an entrepreneur, I think people feel like everything's against them. But then when you flip it around and go, you can outlast the big guys. As long as you don't go crazy with money, as long as you don't blow the money up against the wall, we were talking about spending money foolishly earlier. Like, as long as you just, that's a really good insight. I think a lot of people don't think about that of like,
you can outlast them. I love taking on big guys.
You can dig in.
I get a great kick, you know, if I get attacked in some way or form, whether somebody, you know, one of the large companies would copy my brand or something like that. I love it. I just say, I'm going to take you down. It's just a competitive nature, which probably comes from sports. I just want to attack them and take them down, which is, I think you need as well. You need to have a competitive spirit, don't you?
Let's do our quick fire round.
Okay.
Yeah, I know you're looking forward to this one. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
How to Make Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Great book. Principles Still Last Today, all about looking someone in the eye, shaking their hand, etc. It's a really strong book and has great principles.
What's something you had to learn the hard way?
I didn't expect this one. What's something I had to learn the hard way? Sales. I like just going into... One of the reasons why my company went down was because I wasn't willing to sell. I was afraid of it. And once you can beat that, sales is the most important thing any company has. You can have the greatest CEOs, the greatest accountants, the greatest online technicians, you name it. But if you're not actually selling product, you're gone. So sales is the most important thing. And when I learned to sell, that was when my company went up.
Charlie Butler from Bounce Insights, I think he summed it up better than anyone I've ever heard. Listen, sell, build. In that order. Listen to what people want, sell to them, then build it.
I'm still not great at listening for the selling thing.
But it's like you're going into the back of the classroom just listening and watching and kind of just going, because we get, what makes us great is that we're so singular in vision, but can also be your biggest weakness.
Yep.
What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
I mean, back in the day, you know, when everybody was out having fun, I'm a sociable guy. I always wanted to be out front and center. And my friends laugh at me because they don't remember this bit. But for 2 years, I didn't get on a plane. I didn't go anywhere. I was just literally fighting to pay my mortgage. It ended up being too much. It was like a wave. It ended up taking me out. But back in the day, I sacrificed a social life. I didn't have kids, so I lost my home. That was a sacrifice. Lost my car. The bailiff came to my door and took my car away, which wasn't fun, but I was prepared for it at that stage. I sacrificed mental health, I think, back then. If I think back now, I probably stuck it all in a little compartment in the back of my head. But if I remember, I used to wake up, I used to love sleeping, because sleeping would, you know, I'd have nobody knocking on my door and trying to take away my last penny or what I had. And I was in trouble with all sorts of banks and everything. And I remember waking up every morning, you'd be like this, and the nightmare would start again. Mm. And that happened for about 2 or 3 years. And that took a lot out of me. But then once things get better, I just forgot about it. I never really dealt with it. I was just like, yeah, that's done. Let's move on. So I did sacrifice a lot back then. And I think mainly it was a mental strain. It was just tough. It was like, it was all consuming. And people looking at this will know this, you know, if they're in the restaurant business and they're under pressure and they can't pay debts and whatever, it's a very, very difficult place to be. And the walls kind of continue to close in on you. And but thankfully I pulled out of it, but it was touch and go. I mean, it was, and that's one of the reasons why I really appreciate the life I have, because whenever I think back on waking up in the morning and the nightmare starts again, that was probably a 3-year trip for me, which wasn't fun. I don't want to go back there.
I think that's why it's so nice to hear you talk about that now, because to hear you enjoy your life so much now, I think that's so sweet, and it's so nice to hear people say that, because especially if people are going through it now, they kind of go, this too shall pass.
Like, oh yeah.
This too shall pass. Mm-hmm. It's about endurance and it's about knowing it will get there. Yeah. What would you do today if we give you 10 million euro?
I'd give you back 950 of it. Because I don't want to pay the interest on the 10 million.
I thought you were going to make an investment in me. I was getting all excited there.
So I would. Well, you can invest it if you like. I just think, you know, I think to take a step every day towards your success is a lesson that I would try and teach people. Because today, if you were to start up a drinks business like this, I don't know, you might need £1 million. And that's just mind-boggling. Who the hell's going to have £1 million? You're not going to do it. You know, that's... it's only for the rich. So you can forget about that. But if you have a 10-year dream and you're adding on, you know, you start off with 10 grand and then you compound it, you make 50 grand and 100 and you're building that way. So what I do with the 50 grand is, I think I touched on it earlier, is I think property in the right market is always a great way to make money as long as it's going up. We all know what happens when it goes down in the 07 crash here. But I would trawl the internet and I would just go do a deep dive on that, and I would find out where is the next tourist spot in the world, and I would buy a shack and I would move there and I would do it up and I would Airbnb it. And technology available to us, I mean, you can get great returns on Airbnbs anywhere in the world, as long as the market hasn't tapped out. Like, obviously big cities like Barcelona, Madrid, Dublin, they're all gone. Forget about that. I did it
for 8 years here. It was incredible wave, but every wave ends. So now you need to find a new wave.
Exactly. So there's always, you know, we're eventually going to run out of countries to go to, but there's always a new tourist destination, you know, Sri Lanka, Maldives, those kind of places. And that's what I would do. I would just bury myself in there. I would spend 40 grand buying a shack. I would do it up for 10 grand. I would live in it and I would Airbnb it out and I'd build it up, and then I'd buy another one, and I'd end up with whatever, 8 or 10. And then you'd make a decent income and you always have the final goal up there, but it could be 10 years away. But if I was to tell the guy 10 years, what would you do 10 years ago? You just build like that the whole way up, and it's a staircase. You're never going to straight go, bang, I've got a successful vitamin drink company.
Well, social media has ruined people's perception of hard work. It's ruined people's perception of like stories like you kind of going, oh yeah, just up, straight up. And there's all these people selling courses going, 12 months, you can do 100 grand a month. And you're like, no, you can't.
Yeah, no, you can't.
You need to graft.
No, and I agree wholeheartedly. I just think that there's a lot of poison on the internet of people saying, hey, if you don't like your job, just give it up. And I would say to people, nobody really likes their job. You know, you don't have to love your job. If you just like your job and work in it for 10 years and get to the top of your market from the age of 20 to 30, then you can do what you want, because then you'll be at the top of the tree in your industry, and then you can go off and move. Now, obviously, if you're getting bullied by a boss, that's a different scenario. But if you just don't really like your job, don't quit it and go to Bali. You quit it and go to Bali, in 10 years' time, you're going to be looking back and wishing you'd worked it. And then when you hit 30, then maybe go to Bali. But like, put in the hard yards at that early stage.
Have a plan.
You need 10 years. You've got to stick your head down for 10 years in some sort of an industry in order to make it and become, if you're any good, you'll become a so-called expert in your field in 10 years. You could be at the top of the tree, and then you could move into separate, different companies. And I don't like the idea of, and look, there's lots of young people who come in our company and they'd be there for 2 years and they go and next company. But I don't personally, I might be a bit old school. I don't think that works. I still think hard graft for 10 years in one industry will get you where you want to go.
Yeah, I would agree. I think generally those people are selling you. You are the product. They're selling you a course. They're selling you a dream, or they're selling you some sort of product.
Sell you a lie.
To be honest, right? What's something in your daily routine you wish had started sooner?
The first thing I can think of is health-wise. It's kind of a boring answer, but a friend of mine who's a personal trainer said to me, he said, you know, so many people go to the gym and they'll run and do weights. They'll do aerobic and anaerobic stuff. He said, don't do that. If you go to the gym, do one or the other. You don't want to be half-assed doing something like that. So health-wise, I wish I'd have learned that. I did that a year ago and it's really started to make a difference for me personally. I feel I've got much more energy and I feel like I'm staying in shape easier. So that's something that I think I used to go in for half an hour, look at my phone, look at Instagram, do a little bit of a jog for 10 minutes, do a little bit of beach weights and then leave. And he just said, look, put your head down for 30, 40 minutes doing one thing and one thing only. And I suppose it's kind of like my business, right? That comes full circle.
Just going to say, it's the same, right?
I just focus on VitHit. I have lots of ideas in my phone. For the last 20 years, I've been writing them down, but I'm a one-trick pony. I need to stick to this.
Focus. I think focus is going to become a superpower. Mm. I think it already is. We live in a world of distraction, distracted by everything. Our phones are incredible, but also poisonous. They just kill your focus. So if you can focus on something for 10 years, you will be a success, no matter what it is.
Yep.
I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can only invest it in one company or person. Who is it?
It probably wouldn't be me at the moment because I would have to sell VitHit to do it, but then I'd take it off you and I'd put it into another FMCG brand. I've got 3 or 4 ideas, which I would do. Probably one of your former guests, Bobby Healy. He is a super focused guy. And
he's a machine. He has been come up as an answer. I think he's the most popular answer.
Is he? Yeah, yeah. And Man of Drones is something that not many people are in. And he will become kind of the Uber for people and for companies using it, rather than, you know, taking on Amazon. Someone like Amazon could end up saying, listen, you've got 1,000 of those in the air. We're just going to start using your stuff. So he's building that infrastructure. Now there are a couple of other companies, but he was very, very quick to do that. Now in 10 years time, I would guarantee you it wouldn't be the guy I'd be giving it to. Well, I might give it to Bobby, but I wouldn't be giving it to Man of Drones because there's going to be 200 drone companies around the world, kind of like there is whiskey companies currently. But right now, he is the right guy who has the right experience in the right field. And yeah, he'd be a good guy to throw it into.
I agree. I think that's a strong one. You kind of hinted at this. If you start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
I think it's more what it wouldn't be. I wouldn't do anything that everybody else is doing. I try and find the one thing that people aren't doing. It would be an FMCG. And yeah, we did kind of hint at it earlier, but I would give me an hour. I'd be able to walk down like a Tesco, but something simple like washing up liquid for if someone's got into that, but detergent. I don't think anybody's really done a natural detergent. Maybe there's been one or two companies, but I think that's kind of an open area that you could go into. And I'm just thinking out of my head when you're walking through the aisle of, you know, someone has done now alternative cornflakes. They've done protein with Rice Krispies. They're kind of doing that. So there are young minds going in there, but I can certainly pick out, you know, well, actually here's biscuits, right? Biscuits are full of crap. Mm. There's like, I don't know, there's probably like 30 grams of sugar in every biscuit. Like that's pure heroin. So, you know, why doesn't someone go and try and create a much healthier biscuit and not put it in the alternative aisle, put it in the main aisle? So that's what I did with VitHit. It was a really unhealthy thing to drink, sports drinks, and I just came along and I put a healthy drink in amongst all those unhealthy products and people started to take it. So, yeah, I think I'd probably attack the biscuit aisle.
Okay. What do you believe other people find strange or strongly disagree with?
So what do people disagree with me?
What do you believe that other people find weird or really disagree with you on?
I don't know, you stumped me there. I didn't think there was...
You have a lot of strong views on things. That's definitely...
Well, I suppose the first thing that comes to mind is that what we just discussed, so rather than going over it again, but I didn't think I'd be saying this on any social media thing probably because the, you know, I might get cancelled, but I don't, I think that people are being sold a pup online regularly. I think they're being sold a dog, that you don't have to work. There's no job that you, that, that you can just pick up and be captain of a yacht within a year. There just isn't. So I think most people believe that this whole thing they've been sold, and I hope it turns around soon, but you know, if you don't like the job you're in, just leave and go to Bali. You know, you'll come back from Bali in 10 years time and you'll still want the same job. You'll have to get the same job because you can't live on nothing. So, and not everybody can be an influencer. So I just think that's a bad idea, and a lot of people don't agree. They're like, oh, you're old school, it's different now, you know, we can live offline and we can live off grid and we can do that kind of thing. I still don't think things haven't changed in 1,000 years in that way. You have to stick to your industry and stay there.
I agree. I think you won't get cancelled. I think we're okay. We're safe on that one. Mm. What do you spend money on in your personal life that brings you immense happiness?
Well, like everybody, I think your kids are number one. So you spend money on education and fun things for them. But because we're in the sun, I don't spend money on bringing to the beach. You know, we go to the beach once a week maybe, and nothing makes me happier than seeing the kids in sunshine and running up and down the beach and doing really simple things. Like our kids, my kids, everyone's kids are all, you know, the minute they see a phone, they're like, I want to see the phone. And it's a really hard job for parents to try and take the phone away and say, look at the sunshine, look at the beach, get out there and play. So that makes me the happiest. And I, you know, I, it's, if you're asking me what do I spend money on that makes me happy, I don't. The things, I spend money on things that are necessary to me, but the things that make me happy are seeing my kids with their friends. That's actually that and doing some fun stuff. But actually, if I see my little boy who's 3 years of age running around with his friend, I'm just like, job done.
Yeah.
You know, if the worst thing ever is you see a kid on their own, what they call it, bored, but they're actually lonely. You know, if you have a kid on their own and they don't have friends around, that just kills me. And so much so that when I first moved, the last two moves I've done, I've been like a weirdo with my kid in my arm, knocking on doors, looking for friends for my kids. I've done that in two countries now. And when we arrived in Dubai 3 years ago, I literally grabbed my daughter's hand. She said, where are we going? I said, we're going to meet some friends. And I just knocked on pretty much every door in the estate. There was 32 doors. And I knocked on everyone until I found kids.
There's that salesman in you.
Yeah. But like, it just became like a necessity. That once my kid, then we found two friends for her. And I'm like, there you go. Got new friends. And from that point, it just makes your life so much easier, you know? So that doesn't cost you anything.
Well, like, if you trace it right back, you've built the life you want, right? You're making the decisions. You've worked and you've spent the money to get yourself into the life that you want. What's your final piece of advice for every entrepreneur or aspiring entrepreneur listening?
For me, it's do one thing every day that scares you. You know, there's always some little part of your business pie chart that you just don't like. Skipping leg day. And it's usually the most important thing that you just don't do. So I would say do one thing that scares you every day. And that came back to me that I was losing money because I was afraid to go out to stores and build my brand and start selling it and making money and bringing in money. And I think for me, that was what saved me. And I think also, probably of similar importance, is don't sweat the failures. You know, at the time, I think back on the small failures that I had and, you know, they'd get into my head or whatever, but you just got to fight through them and you just have to ignore them. Because you're going to have hundreds of failures if you're starting your own business. Every day, if you're in a restaurant, every day you're going to have food going off. You're going to have, you know, food going out that's not cooked right and people complaining and they're going online and giving you bad reviews and that kind of stuff. You just have to fight through it with a smile on your face. And like as I said earlier, you just need one success, you know, out of 100 failures to make it.
I love that. This, I read recently, the success you crave is in the work you're avoiding. I thought that was really apt.
Perfect. That's a better way than I said it.
Gary, that was incredible. Where can people, well, people know where it is, but where can people learn more about you?
I kind of stay a bit low key. It's for me, I don't do that many podcasts, as I say. I probably do like 2 or 3 a year. There's no like major profile in me. It's all about the brand for me. Mm. I mean, if you go to vidhit.com, you can see, read about the products, and anything that's an extension of me will all be in there. For me, it's never been about me. I always wanted to push that brand forward and not me. I'm not the kind of Richard Branson where you get the two for the price of one. Mm. For me, it's all about VitHit. And if I can drag some people in who see what I do here and go towards the brand, that's really the destination for me. You know, I don't come on here so people will know more about me. I come on here so they'll know more about VitHit. So that's kind of the process.
Gary, thank you so much.
Cheers. Thanks for having me, Gary.